Okay, y'all, we're gonna jump in on this today. We're gonna be going over a big hunk of chapters today, seven chapters. I guess we'll be 8 chapters after doing these 1 and 2 chapter bunches. Because of the type of material we're going over, we really are going to have to kind of take it in a bigger chunk this week. We've probably got about, I would say, 3 weeks left in Joshua. And Bill and I were just talking. We may just dive right into Judges after that, just kind of keep the progression going since it's all one progressive story. But we're going to be starting in chapter 12 today. And this is after they've fought those battles that we've been going through, the conquest in southern and northern Canaan. And in chapter 12, as it says in the notes, they're revisiting the conquest made by Moses east of the Jordan. That's verses 1 through 6, and I'll start off by reading those for you. Now, these are the kings of the land whom the people of Israel defeated and took possession of their land beyond the Jordan. And by the way, the structure of these verses is actually going to carry on through the latter part of chapter 12 as well. And the people of Israel defeated and took possession of their land beyond the Jordan toward the sunrise, from the valley of the Arnon to Mount Hermon, with all the Arabah eastward. Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived at Heshbon and ruled from Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of the Arnon, and from the middle of the valley as far as the river Jabbok, the boundary of the Ammonites, that is, half of Gilead, and the Arabah to the sea of Chinnereth eastward, and in the direction of Beth Jeshimoth to the sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, southward to the foot of the slopes of Pisgah, and Og, king of Bashan, one of the remnant of the Rephaim, who lived at Ashtaroth and at Edrei, and ruled over Mount Hermon and Salica, and all Bashan to the boundary of the Jeshurites and the Maacathites, and over half of Gilead to the boundary of Sihon, king of Heshbon. Moses, the servant of the Lord, and the people of Israel defeated them. And Moses, servant of the Lord, and Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave their land for a possession to the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh. Now, this may just sound like you're just recounting some historical facts, but there's some specific reasons why this is significant. First of all, it is a reminder to the Israelites, as well as to future generations. It is a reminder of what Moses accomplished, right? It's a reminder of what Moses accomplished in the conquests themselves. These are the kings that Moses led the armies and defeated. But it is also a reminder of what Moses promised. It's a reminder of what he promised. It's not only a reminder of what they accomplished over there, but it's a reminder of what he promised to those tribes. Right? It's important that that was brought out in there as well, because it's part of a larger list of kings conquered by God in the Promised Land, as well as on the Transjordan area. Because it goes directly into, starting at verse 7 through the end of the chapter, all the kings defeated by Joshua. So it's a grouping, it kind of separates them to one degree, but the way the progression goes, it's still part of one long series of conquests. But it so is a conscious grouping of the Transjordan tribes, which are the ones east of the Jordan, along with the tribes west of the Jordan. So Moses' conquest and Joshua's were essentially one. They were essentially one. And the reason that it's a reminder of what Moses promised to the eastern tribes, they needed to be reminded, and all the children of Israel needed to be reminded, that they are part of the promised land too. That they were part of the promised land too. Even though the promise had been made to them before they ever started conquering the land west of the Jordan, that was going to be their land because they were going to come over and fight along with their fellow tribes.
So, does everybody have a map in their Bible? Do they have a map of this?
Yeah.
So, I can look at this in the Bible. So it has a map of where everybody sits as Joshua is taking it up with the half tribe of Manasseh over here, and Gad, and Reuben.
Mm-hmm.
And you got the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee right here. And Joshua, just big picture, Joshua is coming in right through here. And he goes south and conquers all of them, and then going to go north and get the rest. Okay? But as they're crossing this Jordan, where the guys were standing in the middle of the river and a big pile of stones, you know, coming right in here, and then right across, you got that Mount Gerizim, and this is where they had that little seminar.
Mm-hmm. Seminar.
It was a review of all the law, mm-hmm. and then they go south and they get everybody. So I don't know if y'all's Bibles have that, but I mean you can.
It
lays out all where the tribes are.
I don't know why I didn't print that out. I should have printed that out. Y'all was giving y'all a good visual.
Picture of really what's going on, and then you know when they leave these tribes on one side, on this side of the Jordan, and then take all the mighty men, and they say, okay. Got to stay here. We're going to go across. Then it's like a lecture to the tribes that are on the, what did you call them?
The Transjordan, which is the eastern side.
The eastern side. Don't you guys come and help the folks take over the land on the western side. So, I think that's a good idea. Why don't we pass that around? It's really a clear map.
Yeah, and all the color coding.
See if you can find Garrison on there right in the middle. You just pass it.
And you can see there, when you look at that map, you can actually see, you know, we talked earlier about how last week, how when they crossed over and they initially went into Canaan, they drove a wedge right through the middle of it. You remember talking about that last week? They drove a wedge right through the middle of it into central Canaan so that the northern tribes and southern tribes were essentially cut off from each other. And then the northern tribes did their thing, and then the southern tribes tried their thing, and that basically separated the armies.
So and as you're reading through this chapter, you can find all those kings and all
every
those
one of
cities
them, yeah.
on that map and see what they're doing.
And it was both the eastern tribes and the western tribes needed to hear that Transjordan group was part of Israel too. And they needed to hear this. And actually, this will come up probably next week in the section that we're going to be talking about next week. And I'll just give you a little heads up on it. That those 2.5 eastern tribes, on their side of the Jordan, they built an altar. And the western tribes saw them building that altar, and they started gathering their armies to go wipe them out because they thought that they were going to be offering sacrifices over there that they weren't supposed to be doing. And they said, no, far be it from us, we are not offering sacrifices. This is an altar of remembrance. There will be no sacrifices, no blood offerings made here. This is just a remembrance of what has been done. And what they're basically doing is, we're erecting this so you guys know that we're part of you too still. We aren't doing our own thing over here and separating ourselves from you. We're one with you. And that's what the altar was really meant for. So we'll talk about that more next week, or the week after, I guess. But then there is a listing of the kings of Joshua, that the kings defeated by Joshua. And as it says in verses 7 and 8, he basically talks about the geography of them in general, the borders. But then starting in verse 9, I'm not necessarily going to revisit through all of the... Well, I guess we can. I'll go ahead and start at verse 7. I'll read that. And by the way, the reason I'm reading this is to spare you guys having to read them and pronounce them in front of everybody, because I'll lay myself out and mispronounce them. I'm okay. These are the kings of the land whom Joshua and the people of Israel defeated on the west side of the Jordan, from Baal-Gad in the valley of Lebanon to Mount Halak that rises towards Seir. And Joshua gave their land to the tribes of Israel as a possession according to their allotments, in the hill country, in the lowland, in the Arabah, in the slopes, in the wilderness, and in the Negeb, the land of the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And by the way, well, I'll get to it in a second. I'll go ahead and read through this. The king of Jericho, one. The king of Ai, which is beside Bethel, one. The king of Jerusalem, one. The king of Hebron, one. The king of Jarmuth, one. The king of Lachish, one. The king of Eglon, one. The king of Gezer, one. The king of Debir, one. The king of Gadir, one. The king of Horma, one. The king of Erech, one. The king of Libna, one. The king of Adullam, one. The king of Makeda, one. The king of Bethel, one. The king of Tapua, one. The king of Hefer, one. The king of Aphek, one. The king of Lasharon, one. The king of Madon, one. The king of Hazor, one. The king of Shimron Meron, one. The king of Aksaph, one. The king of Tanakh, one. The king of Megiddo, one. The king of Kedesh, one. The king of Jokneam and Carmel, one. The king of Dor and Napath Dor, one. The king of Goyim and Galilee, one. The king of Tirzah, one. In all, 31 kings. What do y'all notice about that besides all the weird names, the way he says it? What do y'all notice that's strange about that?
One.
Yeah. Why do you think he did that? Why would y'all think that? Huh?
Were they not united kingdoms?
No, they weren't united kingdoms. I mean, that's true. He's pointing that out, but there's something else he's pointing out when you think about it, depending on how you read it. Barry, what do you think? What do you think? You were about to say something.
I was going to say the only one that's going to be left.
All right, when you go to an Alabama football game, at the beginning, they usually like show the last part of the season or the last year's game against the prior team,
uh-huh.
And they show a touchdown.
Yeah.
And it is, I'm sorry.
No, it's true.
God is saying, and we beat that one. And that one.
Exactly.
And that one. And that one. And that one. And as you go through that, if you were following on the map, it was the whole country.
Exactly. So what he basically was doing was, it was significant in the number of kings, and as we said, it's not like the 31 flavors, the 31 kings, but it's significant in just the sheer number of it, the enormity of it, and it's significant in the individuality of it. These were 31 battles. It's almost like if you think about World War II, yeah, we won the war. But there was the Battle of the Hurricane Forest. There was the Battle of Bastogne. You know, there was the Battle of Saipan and Okinawa. You know, there were individual battles that people fought and died, and each one was won. They were individual battles, and they have significance in their individuality, because if you you kind of recount, like there's some old guy who is willing to talk a little bit about what he did in the war, which a lot of times they don't, but he'll say, I fought on Okinawa. Or, I think I've mentioned this story before. Tom Brokaw, in his book The Greatest Generation, his mom was a postal clerk. And when there was a guy who just worked on heating systems in the town, who an older guy, and he was kind of complaining. It was the day after Halloween, and a bunch of kids had been kind of just being stupid, you know, around the town, and he was kind of complaining about that. And Tom Brokaw's mother said, "Oh, come on, lighten up. I mean, what were you doing when you were 18? He goes, "I was on Guadalcanal." And walked out. You know, he knew exactly where he had been in that battle. And there's a significance to that. That's why he's naming these kings, individual kings. Plus, when you look at it that way, when you think about each tribe in their particular area that they have, they know that God fought that battle in their piece of land. You know, yeah, I'm in this tribe and Lachish is in our area, and we fought that battle. We got that town. God fought for us in that town. So it wasn't like somebody can say, "Yeah, God handled all this for everybody else, but we took care of our area ourselves." It's not what happened. It's not what happened. So it was not only the significance of the huge numbers of them corporately, but each individual battle was its own specific thing. Each one had its own challenges. Might have been different numbers of people, might have been different types of weaponry, it might have been different terrain, it might have been a bigger wall around the city. But each one had its unique challenges, and each one God fought for them and led them to victory. Then, as we move into chapter 13, it talks about, now Joshua was old and advanced in years, and the Lord said to him, "You are old and advanced in years, and there remains yet very much land to possess." Now, we tend to think that with all these kings and all this land that was taken, and all these battles that were won, that it was all done. But it was not. There was still very much land to possess. And then he says, "This is the land that yet remains, all the regions of the Philistines, and all those of the Geshurites, from the Shihor, which is east of Egypt, northward to the boundary of Ekron. It is counted as Canaanite. And there are five rulers of the Philistines, those of Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron, and those of the Avim in the south, all the land of the Canaanites, and the Mira that belongs to the Sidonians, to Aphek, to the boundary of the Amorites, and the land of the Gebelites, and all Lebanon, toward the sunrise from Baal-Gad, below Mount Hermon, to Labo Hamath, all the inhabitants of the hill country from Lebanon, to Mishrephoth, Maim, even all the Sidonians. I myself will drive them out." This is God speaking. "I myself will drive them out from before the people of Israel. Only allot the land to Israel for an inheritance, as I have commanded you. Now, therefore, divide this land for an inheritance to the nine tribes and half the tribe of Manasseh." So, these are areas that have not yet been taken, but God is still saying, basically, figure this in as you're dividing the land up, which I thought was interesting. So he had basically given them a blueprint for the areas that are still to be possessed. Those are, and if you look at them on the map, these are basically the outskirts of the promised land. It's the outskirts. It's the kind of the all the mopping up areas in the remote, distant areas. The main body, though, had been taken. So this was, in a sense, that mopping up work that can sometimes take a while. But Joshua was to divide the land, assuming that God would drive them out as he had the others. That God would drive them out as he had the others. And the eastern tribe's land, which starting in verse 8, he divided up. And he goes very specifically of the cities and the borders. This is for Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben, the two and a half tribes there. But I'm not going to get into the details of all that. We'll just get dizzy reading all these names. But there's something significant, though, about the tribe of Levi, the way it's mentioned. It's mentioned in verse 14 and at the very end of chapter 13. It says in verse 14, "To the tribe of Levi alone Moses gave no inheritance." The offerings by fire to the Lord God of Israel are their inheritance, as he said to them. And notice how he's talking about Moses. Moses did this. The reason why, this was part of the land that Moses made promises to. He's letting them know that Moses specifically said that no, Levi was not to have an inheritance among this land as far as the land proper. He also says in verses 32 and 33, these are the inheritance that Moses distributed in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan east of Jericho. But to the tribe of Levi, Moses gave no inheritance. The Lord God of Israel is their inheritance, just as he said to them. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later, in the later chapters. But the Lord himself is their inheritance, and the offerings given to him will be theirs. So those offerings are what they will have. They will not have a land of inheritance, but cities to dwell in among the others, which we will see in the later chapters. Now, as we move into chapter 14 through 19, this is a big chunk. There's a couple of things to draw out of it. First of all is, as he is describing the borders and boundaries of the area west of the Jordan, he deals with starting at, he mentions at the beginning of chapter 14, a section regarding the tribe of Levi. When we get into 14, he's talking about Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun did the dividing of up of things. Okay, their inheritance was by lot, just as the Lord had commanded by the hand of Moses for the 9.5 tribes. For Moses had given an inheritance to the 2.5 tribes beyond the Jordan, but to the Levites he gave no inheritance among them. For the people of Joseph were 2 tribes, that's Ephraim and Manasseh. And no portion was given to the Levites in the land, but only cities to dwell in, and with their pasture lands for their livestock and their substance. The people of Israel did as the Lord commanded Moses. They allotted the land. So the significance of the Levites, the priestly tribe, was they were going to be scattered basically throughout the promised land and given cities to dwell in, because they were going to be serving throughout the land. Okay? So that, and with the offerings being given, is where their inheritance would largely lie. But then we get at verse 6, we get to Caleb. And his faithfulness back many years ago, 45 years ago, basically, his faithfulness was rewarded. And the people of Judah came to Joshua at Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, "You know what the Lord said to Moses." He's reminding him of what the Lord said to Moses back then. "The man of God in Kadesh Barnea concerning you and me. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. And I brought him word again as it was in my heart. But my brothers who went up with me made the people of the heart, the heart of the people melt." Excuse me. "Yet I wholly followed the Lord my God. And Moses swore on that day, saying, 'Surely the land on which your foot has trodden shall be an inheritance for you and your children forever, because you have wholly followed the Lord, my God. Now behold, the Lord has kept me alive, just as he said, these 45 years. Since that time the Lord spoke this word to Moses, while Israel walked in the wilderness. And now behold, I am this day 85 years old. I am still as strong today as I was in the day that Moses sent me. My strength now is as my strength was then, for war and for going and coming. So now give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke on that day, for you heard on that day how the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. It may be that the Lord will be with me and I shall drive them out, just as the Lord said." So this is an area that has not been fully possessed. Okay? But Caleb, and as we'll see later in chapter 15, they do take that land. But then it says, "Then Joshua blessed him, and he gave Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, for an inheritance. Therefore Hebron became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, to this day, because he wholly followed the Lord, the God of Israel. Notice that that is mentioned three times, because he wholly followed the Lord. The people are letting him know not only what happened, but why, and it's multiple times. It is mentioned multiple times, three times in that passage. And also, it's interesting that the only two guys who were alive back then when Moses made that promise were Joshua and Caleb. They were the only ones still alive from that, because everyone else had died off. So Caleb had to go to Joshua and say, "You remember now, you remember." Because it could be right after that, somebody could say, "Nobody here remembers that." You know, but Caleb knew and Joshua knew, and Joshua followed through on that promise that was made to him by Moses. Then the allotment, starting in 15, for Judah began. And let's see, there's a couple of things to bring out. We do see, starting in verse 13 through 19, you see Caleb taking the area of Hebron. Basically he said in verse 16, Caleb said, "Whoever strikes Kiriath Sefer and captures it, to him I will give Aksa, my daughter, as wife." And Othniel, his brother, captured it. So that is how that occurred in that one. But what is significant to remember is at the very end of chapter 15, we see trouble starting. We see trouble starting. It's mentioned very lightly, not very much in depth, but it's the beginning of trouble. At verse 63, for all these places that they have been taken. Now, starting at verse 20 all the way through 61, there's just all these places that were taken. But then, but the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the people of Judah, could not drive out. So the Jebusites dwelt with the people of Judah at Jerusalem to this day. And so the Jebusites actually were not driven out until generations later in the time of David. David was the one who finally drove out the Jebusites from Jerusalem. But that was the beginning of trouble. As we move into chapter 16, we see Ephraim and Manasseh mentioned again, just as a side thing, as part of the tribe of Joseph. And we also see in verse 10.
So, why do you in 63 back there?
Yeah.
Why do you think it says could not drive them out?
That's a good question. It doesn't really say.
When God was so powerful, knocking out of Jericho and Ai and all those others, and you get there, and these guys were just stronger than God. I don't have an answer.
It doesn't say. That's interesting. That is an interesting part of it. It doesn't say. And I want to connect it to 16:10, because it says, however, they did not drive the Canaanites who lived in Gezer. So the Canaanites have lived in the midst of Ephraim to this day, but have been made to do forced labor. It's almost like there's a little bit of a justification for that not happening. But see, that was the seed of the intermarriage that occurred and the polluting of the people that occurred later, was these people living amongst them instead of being completely driven out. And one of the commentators on this mentioned that was kind of interesting. He said, you know, they don't say a lot about it, but subtle sin usually doesn't get a lot of press. The press happens when the full fruits of it come later, when there was all the intermarrying and pollution and worshiping the gods of those people. that happened, Baal worship and everything else, that's when it becomes a big deal. But they don't see that at that particular point in time, it was just kind of... I'm not saying you have to become a Nazi over every little thing, but at the same time, we have to understand that subtle sin can easily be ignored. They did not follow through on this. And, you know, it doesn't say that they cried out to God, please help us with this. It doesn't say. It doesn't really say. It just may have said they kind of, maybe they did just a little token attempt and didn't really get it, so they just kind of decided to move on. We don't know. We don't really know.
It said they did not drive the Canaanites out. And if they lived in the midst of them, they were doing forced labor. It didn't say they couldn't.
It could have been that they made some kind of deal similar to the way... Well, of course, the other one was a deception.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But with this one, it could have been they just kind of may have straight up said to them,
okay,
we'll make a deal. We'll do forced labor for you. You know? But they didn't follow through on that. They didn't follow through on totally removing them from the land. But as a foretelling of future trouble. Now, I'm not going to continue to go through the remainder of the next chapters, but when you go through all this, how detailed the tribes and the geography is. And for us now, this just gets tedious. For us now, it's tedious. But if you were reading it like the Jews of that time, it's really important. And for that matter, even now, when I listen to a book on tape about the Six-Day War in 1967, the way they were describing these battles, they literally were, these battles in 1967 were calling back to biblical times. That both sides were talking about recovering the land, you know, that Moses promised, or that, you know, was fought for by Caleb, or, you know, they'll actually say that to their soldiers thousands of years later, you know. And so there was a significant generational contact made there, even in 1967. But during this time, think of it like a will, or almost like a legal document. You know, what do you see when you see legal documents of sale on land? They've got a survey, don't they? They've got a little way down to that rock right there, or, you know, a very specific longitude and latitude. You know, I mean, it's tight, down to the foot and the inch. A lot of times these surveys. And that's basically, at their level, what they're doing right here. So there will be no misunderstanding between the tribes. There will be no misunderstanding of the tribes. And understand that that wasn't just a document to protect them from battling against each other. It was a will in the sense of it is a bequeath from God to all the generations within this tribe. And it was significant. There was such a generational tie to it that it was an enormous deal for someone to not enter into their inheritance or not maintain their inheritance. An example of that is in 1 Kings chapter 21, a very well known story, the story of Ahab, and Naboth's vineyard. Right? The story of Naboth's vineyard. It says, now, you know, Ahab was obviously a very unrighteous and ungodly king. It says, now Naboth, the Jezreelite, had a vineyard in Jezreel beside the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. And after this, Ahab said to Naboth, give me your vineyard, that I may have it for a vegetable garden, because it is near my house. And I will give you a better vineyard for it, or if it seems good to you, I will give you its value in money. But Naboth said to Ahab, the Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers. It wasn't just like a sentimental thing, but it was the inheritance of his fathers. And Ahab went into his house vexed and sullen because of what Naboth the Jezreelite had said to him, for he had said, I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers. And he lay down his bed, turned away his face, and would eat no food. He pouted. And of course, Jezebel worked it to get that. But the underhandedness of which that land was taken spelled Ahab's death warrant. His death warrant.
Where did you say that was?
1 Kings 21. So, one other, or a couple of things to mention in chapter 19. One is when the tribe of Dan is starting in 1940, chapter 19, verse 40. When the seventh lot came out for the tribe of the people of Dan, according to their clans, and it's got all these clans laid out, but it says, in verse 47, when the territory of the people of Dan was lost to them, the people of Dan went up and fought against Leshem, and after capturing it and striking it with the sword, they took possession of it and settled in it, calling Leshem Dan after the name of Dan, their ancestor. Do you remember we talked about how last week that there was a driving out that you could do, but it was not a complete possession of the land? That, you know, you fought the battle, you struck a city, but then you were having to move on to the next area of conquest, and some of these people that might have run off into the hills came back down and retook the city. That's kind of what was going on. And, you know, we saw that a lot of times when you read stories about World War II and that kind of thing. There'll be cities that'll be taken one day, lost the next, taken one day, lost the next, to the point where it's just like this big pile of rubble that they're just fighting over a bunch of rocks, or a hill that would be taken and lost multiple times over a number of days. That's basically what was happening with this city, that it had been taken, but then it was lost again. So the tribe of Dan themselves had to retake it and completely take control of it. Then lastly, at the end of chapter 19, you see the inheritance that is given to Joshua. So when they had finished distributing the several territories of the land as inheritances, the people of Israel gave an inheritance among them to Joshua the son of Nun. By command of the Lord, they gave him the city that he asked, Timnath-Serah in the hill country of Ephraim. And he rebuilt the city and settled in it. These are the inheritance that Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the heads of the fathers' houses of the tribes of the people of Israel distributed by lot at Shiloh before the Lord at the entrance of the tent of meeting. So they finished dividing the land. So it was a very solemn occasion. It happened at the entrance of the tent of meeting. It was at Shiloh. And it was significant. It was like the reading of God's will, almost. You know, not that God had died, but you know, it was reading of the inheritances and giving those out and laying out the boundaries. It was very significant. I think next week we're doing the congregational meeting thing on the constitutional stuff, so definitely the week after that we will start getting into chapters 20 and 21, which talks a lot about the cities of refuge and the cities and pasture lands along in the promised land that were allotted to Levi. And then we'll also finish out some stuff with the eastern tribes and Joshua's final speech over the next few weeks. Are there any other comments or thoughts?
This is just a wild one. And it may sound like it's a joke, but I'm not really joking. Just, you know, Shiloh in is it Tennessee or North Mississippi?
It's Western Tennessee, yeah.
Was one of the bloodiest battles of the Civil War. Is there any tie to, I mean, just what, Shiloh was the splitting up place for, just does that go give any parallel to the bloodiest place?
I would just say that, no, that's just where that city was named from. It wasn't named because of the Battle of Shiloh.
Oh, I know that.
But
it just happened to be
a very bloody battle, yeah.
But it's just something to think about.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, isn't it? Yeah. That is cool.
Shiloh means peace.
But there was no peace in our Shiloh.
General Grant was not over in these battles.
He was not there. He was not at this
point. But it is, you know, just on the Civil War, it's, you know, that's named Shiloh. It's one of the bloodiest battles. It's just
the opposite.
Not lost on a lot of the
bloodiest.
You know, it's really kind of a sad statement of my personal state of mind that when I think of Shiloh in Tennessee, there was a customer of mine that I had there when I was sold industrial gases. It was Shiloh Foods, and they made hush puppies and cornbread dressing. So when I think of Shiloh, I think of hush puppies and cornbread dressing more than I think of the Civil War battle. What are you going to do?
So in today's time, Dave, you know, God laid out this plan, and it was carried out in that part of the country, like that map that we looked at. So, you know, he seems to, and I'm not a historical person, but anyway, what's the significance of that region now? How did it just, you figured all those people there that faded kind of into the a little bit with some significance in our country to protect Israel a little bit, but nothing else to the point. Not that it had anything to do with us, but it all leads up understanding the Christ and salvation through Him. That's the gospel. But is there anything there in the big picture?
Yeah, I would say there is. When you think about the geography of it, it's significant. First of all, you know, you can say it's the cradle of the world when you look at, you know, the creation story and, you know, where the garden was and all these places from the earliest times of antiquity that we have. That's considered like the cradle of the world.
Are you talking about Israel proper?
Well, but even when you get specific to Israel, there's something else. If you try to think from the standpoint of God's redemptive plan, and I'm not trying to put, like, you know, what does somebody say when you're trying to figure out where to put a convenience store? There's three things to think about: location, location, and location, right? Because you got all the traffic. It's going to hit a particular intersection, and you got to have where, okay, is the access road there? You get plenty of good access roads. That'll spell the success or failure of a venture really quick. Where Israel is located, that particular piece of land, it is a land bridge between continents. Europe, Asia, Africa. That's the land bridge, is that little stretch of land. And so, even if you think from the standpoint of the time of Christ and when the gospel was just taking root and you had evangelists talking about the man who died for our sins and rose from the dead and was God and all this kind of stuff, how many people were going through that area to other parts of the world? An incredible sum when you think about the general sense of mobility of the people of that time, which was not a lot. But if there was one place that you were going to have people from all over the world going through, it was that area, that little piece of land. So what it fostered from the standpoint of the spread of the gospel was enormous. enormous. You know, what's the guy, the Egyptian, Ethiopian eunuch, you know, that was going through there? You know, you could say, in a sense, he was the first missionary down to that whole part of the world. You know, and you had other people going up the northern end of, up into Europe, and you had other people going east, all from that little area right there, because that's where all the roads intersected.
So,
that was why it was important to Rome. That was why it was important to Rome during that time.
And you know, I know this is getting into eschatology, but just generally in reading Psalms and all areas of the Bible, God is, his intention is that all the world is his. Everything. And it is. It's told that it is now. The Holy Land is definitely a launching pad, as you've seen it, and Christianity spread from there. But the way to look at it today, I think, is that all the world is God's, and we, where we're placed, we are doing what Joshua was doing in Ephraim or wherever back then. He's looking at where we are today, like he was standing on Mount Gerizim and thinking about the law. And that's how we live today. So I don't think there's any magic to the Holy Land anymore, and that the, you know, the Solomon's temple is rebuilt and on a train somewhere to come in, so that the tribulation can start and all of that. I don't know.
Any other comments? Bill, can you close us?
Heavenly Father, thank you for this day, and thank you for the example of the children of Israel and the conquering of the promised land.